You can do anything you want, but you can't introduce me. So sit down.
Okay, so thank you again, Rabbi Bernstein and Micah. Just to tell you, next week is Rabbi Adler. The week after that is Rabbi Chanan Dulitz.
Rabbi. What?
Of course. Said, yeah, Rabbi Chanan Dulitz. Yeah. After that is Dr. Berger. And after that is, I know, but he goes here as Dr. Berger. Yeah. All right. And the week after that is Rabbi Eli Rubin.
It's a rabbinical batting order. Okay, I entitled this reading Lech Lecha 2,000 years ago because what I did is to choose a couple of passages from the Dead Sea Scrolls which deal with Parshas Lech Lecha and put it in the context of the history of Jewish biblical interpretation. The first one is actually really interesting. It'll take a little longer, I think, than the other one. And it's a very famous question. It's a question that everybody knows. I mean, you know, maybe I'll say a word or two about the scroll that we're looking at a little bit later. But the problem is a problem that's very well known. It's found in it's implied in Seder Olam. Seder Olam Rabbah, it's in the Rishonim, and it's very interesting to see how the Rishonim jump on this one. That's one of the things I'm interested in talking about and looking at. So this is what I like to call, there are two chronological problems that intersect. One is what I call, we'll call the 400-430 problem, which is how long are the Jews in Golus, in slavery, in whatever. There's a pasuk that says in Brachos Tesvav, which is the third passage on the sheet, Yoda Teidaki Geri Ezarachov Eretz Lolohem Vabodum Vinu Osam Arbameos Shana, 400 years. And the pasuk in Shmos, towards the end of Perek Yud Beit, says Moshav Bnei Yisrael Ashi Yashivu B'Mitzrayim Shloshim Shana V'Arbameos Shana. So we have 430 years. And this is a very, very famous issue. Now, how does this intersect with yet a different problem? It intersects with the problem of what I'll call, did Abraham make a pilot trip to Eretz Yisrael before he made Aliyah finally? And we'll see that according to Seder Olam and some of the Rishonim who follow it, that indeed he did. So we see the first quotation from the end of Parshas Noach, which is why I told Howie I could have given this year Noach also. Terach lives for 70 years, and Terach has Avram at the age of 70. And we get the little narrative about the family and the wives. And then the last underlined, the second underlined passage, Vayikach Terach has Avram Beno. And then Vayetzu Itam Eur Kastim Lelechas Arza Kenoan Vayavo Ad Charon Vayishvu Sham Vayume Sarach Chameshinim Asam Sham Vayume Sarach Charon. So Terach takes Avram, and they leave Ur Kastim on the way to Eretz Canaan, which is an interesting question. Why is Terach going to Eretz Canaan? But that's not our issue here. Some of the Rishonim actually touch on it. And they stop in Haran. How old is Avram when he leaves Haran? That's an explicit pasuk in this week's parsha of Avram ben Chamesha Nivishivim Shana, but say so me Haran. So the standard answer to the 400-430 problem is to play with the story of Avram. And, you know, the way that we play with this story is to, let's read the Seder Olam. The first quotation comes from Seder Olam Rabbah, in the first chapter. Seder Olam is a chronological work trying to work out all of the dates in Torah and later, and in a rabbinic framework, but it's more complicated than that. There was a new edition published a few years ago, and who wrote Seder Olam? It's attributed to Rabbi Yosef ben Chalafta. Whether he actually wrote it or not, we could have our. It's like any other rabbinic work, which is attributed to someone. After your name. So Avram Avinu hayobishosh nidbar imo ben absarim ben shivim shana. So Avram is 70 years old at the time of Bris Ben Habsarim. Yeah, I understand the question. Because the pasuk says, at the end of 430 years, etc. After La'achar Shenidbar Imo, after God speaks with him then, Yorad Lecharon. It's interesting. Yorad, he made Yerida temporarily. V'asa sham chamesh shanim, and he spends 5 years there. Shenem avavom chamesh shanim mishim mishem v'tzeisam echaron. So this is the solution to the problem. We need one other small fact. If you're going to count 400, where does that 400 count from? And this is going to be very interesting because we're going to see that the 400 number counting from when? From the birth of Yitzchak is actually going to be shared by the writer at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which it's one of those shared ancient traditions which you can no longer say, oh, it's just the Chazal, because it's there even earlier. So we're gonna find out that the 400 counts from the birth of Yitzchak, and that means that the 430 has to be 30 years before the birth of Yitzchak, when Avram therefore is 70 years old. But there's another problem. Now we have created a monstrous a muktam u'uchar b'Torah. We've taken the Brit Ben Hamtarim, which is chapter 15 of this week's parasha in Lech Lecha. And we've said that it takes place back when Avram is still in, he's in Eretz Yisrael, but he comes to Eretz Yisrael when he's 70 years old, and then goes back to Mesopotamia. So that is yet one more question that creates the problem.
Well, the issue is that he's back in Haran. You can just say, well, towards the finishing of the Torah.
No, it's not. The Ein Muktam Meuchar is much more serious than that. Because you also have to decide, and some Rishonim actually touch on this, you also have to decide when the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings takes place. You know, where does that fit in the 70 or 75? I hadn't actually given much thought to it until...
And
of course, when does he get the Tzivui to leave? So the simplest, you know, rationales really make this pretty difficult. So now we... And now I'm going to just show you how some Rishonim are reacting to this position of the Seder Olam. And I just picked a few, actually. Ibn Ezra, in the short commentary on Shmos, Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on Shmos. It's from the long commentary, I apologize. And he writes, V'hutzrach baal Seder Olam lomar, ki achar sheba Avraham l'eretz Kanan shav l'charan. Notice where he's saying this. He's saying this in his commentary on Shmos, Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Mem, where we have the 430 number. So Ibn Ezra says, and the language is not nice, right? The author of Seder Olam was compelled to say that after he went to Eretz Yisrael, he then went back to Haran. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, who's a Talmud of Rashi, was one of the Balei HaTosfos, also in his commentary on Shmos, in that chapter, Umafarish b'seder olam, ki kodem shaya ben shivim yotza mecharan tchila, that he left earlier than 70, and when he was 70, nigla alav HaKadosh Baruch Hu ben habsarim, v'chazar l'charan, he had the Gilui Shechina, goes back, v'asa sham Chameh Shanim, spends 5 years there. V'achar kach yotza pam shniya. V'zeu shekosuv. V'avrov ben chameh shanim v'shivim shana b'tzei so mecharon. And that's why he's 75 when he leaves. Now, those two we're going to see in a very few moments. Ibn Ezra and Bechor Shor are two of the Mefarshim who reject the Seder Olam interpretation. I split up the quotations. We'll see that they reject. But here we have two Rishonim from Ashkenaz, incidentally, both of them, Rashbam, and Rashbam is one that surprises me the most, because he is the most independently pshat of all the Rishonim, and he nevertheless here says, Moshe ben Yisrael, Shesh ben Yisraim, Ad Sof Shloshim Shana, V'Arbameos Shana, Mishenemar Li Avraham ben Habsarim, Ki Ben Shivim Shana, Hayo Avraham Avinu, Kshinidbar Imo ben Habsarim, V'Arbameos Shilgeri Yazaracha, Hischilu mi Yitzchak, Kemoshe Peirashti Hakol, the Parshas Ben Habsarim. The problem is we don't have Rashbam's commentary to the first three Sedras in Chumash. So he tells us that he did it, But we don't have the text of his commentary, and I went looking, and I realized, no, we don't have that. It's just one of those things. We have the first page of the commentary, so what we have on the first parak of Bereishis we have, and after that, until Vayera, we don't have. That's the luck. Chizkuni, who is a late Ashkenaz Rishon also, says, B'tseiso mecharon, he says it in Lech Lecha, a second time. The way it says in Seder Olam, he goes back to Haran, spends 5 years there, as it says, Rabban ben Chamesh, Vishivim Mishanah, B'tseiso mecharon. So this is the standard answer that I'm sure that if you remember learning this in grade school, because this is what Rashi says, and this is the way that Chazal responded to this. Now turn the page. I'm very happy I was able to put this on two sides because I didn't want you cheating. Okay. This is a commentary from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It has the fancy name of Commentary on Genesis A. It was composed 2nd, 1st century BCE, more than 2,000 years ago. And I remember when I read this passage the first time, and it wasn't reconstructed, the reconstruction is mine, I remember starting to jump up and down in the library, and I grabbed a hold of one of my colleagues. I said, you see, he's solving the 400-430 problem without even mentioning it, which he was doing. So let's look. The obvious reconstructions were there when it was published. The rest, the reconstructed more fully, is what I've done with it. This is one of my favorite Dead Sea Scroll texts. I've published 3 articles on it, and probably will find an excuse to publish some more. Terach is 140 when he leaves Ur Kasdim, it says. And that makes sense, because he gives birth to Avram when he's 70. But now we have a date, according to this text, when he leaves. He leaves when he is 140, and therefore Avram is 70. V'Avram ben Shivim Shana, period. V'chamesh shanim yashav Avram b'charon, v'achar yatzo Avram el eretz Kenan, Shishim Shana Meis Terach, which just tells me that when Avram leaves, Terach is 145, and he dies at the age of 205. Done. The Dead Sea Scrolls are generally anonymous. We don't know. Some guy who inhabited the caves, or one of his relatives, was writing a little perush on Sefer Bereishis, picking on interesting passages. One of the things that makes this a very important text is that most ancient texts, if you want to answer a question, you have to retell the whole story. And we'll see another text that does that a little bit later. But this text goes piece by piece and chooses to answer the question without telling you who's asking the question. If he says that Avram is 70 when he leaves Ur Kasdim, why did he pick 70? Answer, because he is now solving the 400-430 problem. We count, and now I'm just going to borrow from all of the Rishonim on the rest of the page, who say the same thing, that we count the 430 from when Avram leaves his first home, namely Ur Kasdim. And now it goes very, very smoothly. If you take a look, we'll see a variety of Rishonim who go along this Mahalach. Rav Sadia Gaon says, and as far as the 430 years, the travels of Avraham are included in them, and they are the 30 that we mentioned in the Parsha of Yikach Terach as Avraham Beno. And I know that this is what he means, because Ibn Ezra is going to tell me in 2 lines, Ibn Ezra is going to tell me that this is what Rav Sadia Gaon holds. But it's very interesting, the 3, and actually I found a 4th Rishon that actually says it. I knew of 3, and yesterday I found a 4th. Now, Ibn Ezra, remember, in the commentary on Shmos on the first page, said that Seder Olam felt compelled to say that he went back to Haran after he went to Eretz Yisrael. And now Ibn Ezra continues here in the second quotation from Rishonim, Ve'ein Sorech L'chol Zeh. We don't need all that. But the counting of 400 years goes from the day Yitzchak was born, and these 30 are additional. Misparam miyom sheyotza Avraham me'eretz molanto me'ur kastim uva imaviv el charon kasher kasuv ayabod charon vayeshvu sham. So you just start counting when Avram leaves his hometown, Ur Kasdim, and now it's a very, very smooth, it's a smooth count. Avraham, he says, then lives with his father in Haran for 5 years. He goes to Eretz Canaan, and he's 75, and he doesn't go back to Haran. When Yitzchak was born, those 30 years from when Avram left his land was over, because he's the important one, Yitzchak, because he's the one that's given Eretz HaKnaani. And he says it again on the last pasuk, Shloshim Shana V'Arba Me'os Shana, Miyom She'yotza Avraham Avihem Me'eretz Moladto. So this is a very clear statement of what I'll call this, the other solution to the 400-430. In the Perush HaKatzar, which I've given you one line, he quotes Rav Sadia Gaon, Vagon Omar Ki Perusho Ad Sof Shloshim V'Arba Me'os Shana V'Zeh HaKeshbon Miyom Seis Avraham Me'ur Kasdim. Notice Ibn Ezra and Sadia are both non-Ashkenazic Rishonim. And I don't know whether that is relevant or not, because most of the Ashkenazic Rishonim follow Rashi, Seder Olam, and so on. The one that doesn't is Yosef Bechor Shor, whom we saw, again, on the first page, disagreeing with the Seder Olam count, or I mean, talking about the Seder Olam count, and now he says, however, but according to the Pshat, Lufi HaPshat, Hun monem ishi yatsa me'aram tchila ubalach aronim terech aviv, shezeh hayat tchilas galuso. The beginning of Avram's exile was when he went to Haran from Ur Kasdim. Va'oz haya ben shivim, va'amad v'charan heishanim v'yatsa. Notice all of these commentators, as typical medievalists, tell you in detail what they're answering. That funny Qumran text tells you the answer without telling you what question he's answering, because he the whole style is different. Their style was to answer the question without asking it, simply by rewriting the passage in such a fashion that the question goes away. And so on. And this was more than 70 years later. Once again, he rejects the Seder Olam chronology and says this is from the time he came to Haran. Yesterday or the day before, for the first time, I ran into Rabbi Yosef Kaspi's commentary. He's again a Provençal Rishon of the 14th century, if I'm not mistaken. 430 years. Zeh ha-cheshbon hu behechrach miyom hisgorer Avraham Avinu harishon ritzoni me'eis tseiso me'eretz moladto. So here you see a whole collection of Rishonim who all puzzle out the missing 5 years in the same fashion. So obviously this is an interpretation that must have been floating around somewhere. If I'm not mistaken, I once asked an authority on Karaite interpretation if the Karaites interpreted it that way, and she said yes. It happens to be that Sadia, Ibn Ezra, and Bechor Shor all have points of contact at different times with Karaites. I don't know whether that has anything to do with it, but it's an interesting factoid. Perhaps the most interesting of the comments that we will run into on this subject are the ones of the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon, in his notes on Seder Olam, which I just happen to have. I have some very funny books, Birusha. That's one of them. It's falling apart in my hands. And the Gaon writes as follows. Perush, Tav Shana Mishinolad Yitzchak, Ushloshim Shana Kodem Shinolad Yitzchak, Val Karchach Umonem Ishash and Igzerog Zera. That's the Seder Olam he's commenting on. And now listen to the Gaon's language. V'dochak gadol, ki lefi zeh hayashtei pa'amim be'eretz Yisrael. V'gam tzarich lomar, shapsukim ne'emru shelo kesidron. The Gaon is bothered by the Emukdam Me'uchar question. Al karchach nireh, kemo she'omar ba'midrash, shashloshim shana, I mistyped it. Shehitzil oso me'ur kastim. We count the 30 from when God saves him from Ur Kasdim. Umisham hischil hadgeirus. V'halach l'charon, v'shah sham chamei shanim, v'halach l'eretz Yisrael, v'achar shika es hamalachim, it keeps it in order, haya ben habsarim. So why didn't I bring you the midrash that the Gaon is quoting here? And the answer is, because bigger Talmidei Chachamim and greater scholars than I have not been able to find it either. This is a just one of those really weird things. Did the Gaon really see a midrash? Did he dream it? Is it someplace like that we don't know about? Nobody knows about it. The editor of Bechor Shor published, 30, 40 years ago. So he writes on the Bechor Shor passage. By the way, the Gaon says this also in his Seder Olam notes, but I can't find the midrash. And nobody else has been able to find it either. So either the Gaon had a text that we don't have, or he had this incredible insight that somebody in Chazal would have been cholek on Seder Olam and come up with a much more reasonable, much more structured interpretation of the passage. So, you know, this particular vart, as it were, of the Gaon is one that I have always found very sort of exciting. But we see how the commentary that we found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, this little fragmentary 2.5 line piece, fits in with Jewish interpretive tradition. Nobody of these Rishonim, I think, ever saw a trace of this commentary unless it dribbled down to the Karaites, and that's why I mentioned it. The Karaites do have some stuff that seems to have originated in the caves at Qumran. It's very hard to put your finger on what, but some of that stuff actually ended up in the Cairo Geniza, and there are two or three texts from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that we also show up in the Cairo Geniza. How they got there 1,000 years and more later is like one of the puzzles of Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship and Rishonim scholarship. You want to know, there's a dotted line, but you can't trace it very, very well. But here you have the interpretation found in the Dead Sea Scrolls reappearing among the Rishonim for a reason. They don't have, the Dead Sea Scrolls don't have to worry about this Seder Olam thing or anything else. The guy just said what he said. But now I want to say the inferential read, namely that 400 years goes from the birth of Yitzchak. We might not have thought that the Dead Sea group was following, but they are, obviously. Because if you pick 430 to be from when Abram is leaving, and therefore he's 100 at the time that you start counting 400, they're following the same tradition that 400 years counts from the birth of Yitzchak. No place in the Torah does it say that explicitly. I have a Torah Shebal Peh tradition in Chazal, and I implicitly have the same interpretive tradition among the Dead Sea group. And that's sort of an interesting thing. It's always important to find places where there are commonalities. It's more exciting to find, machlokes. But to find commonalities in places which are not explicit in the Pasuk, which show that there is a Jewish interpretive tradition that's going on. And here the Dead Sea document matches with all of Chazal that say that we count 400 from the birth of Yitzchak. Okay. Now I want to go to the other page. And here since the main document is in Aramaic, I just gave you everything in English. And here we have a different story. And it's, again, it's a... It's a question about the nature of the narrative of Avram and Sarai in Egypt. Because you read the story, and Avram says, "Hinei no yodati ki ishoy fas mare'at, v'hayoki ru osoch ha-mitzrim, v'amru ishto zos, v'argozi v'osoch yichayu, imri no achosi at lamani tavi bavarev, cho yisan afshi bigolech." That's the first quotation on the page. And the second quotation is from the Avimelech story, in next week's Parsha, Vahi kasher yitzu osi Elohim beis avi va'omar lo zech astei kasher tasi imodi el kol hamakom asher navo shama imri li achihu. So those, by the way, so I'm going to ask you the first question. No place in the early part of the Avram story does he say this, you know, when, you know, zech astei kasher tasi, etc. So now I'm going to, well, let's read together a brief piece in a document. It's called the Genesis Apocryphon. What it is, it's a collection of narrative, where it starts, the fragments start in Perikei of Bereishis, with the birth of Noach, and whoever, some nasty guy in antiquity, took a sharp object and cut off after column 22, because you can see the sewing is there, you can see the end of the beginning of the next column, and he just cut it off for whatever reason in the middle of a sentence. And I want to get a hold of that guy, because I would have had much more things to say if I had more of the document. But it's very interesting, because some of it we might call midrashic, some of it we would call pshat, and some of it's in between. So here we are, and it's first person narrative. I had a dream, says Avram, on the night of my entering Egypt. I saw in my dream the cedar tree and a palm, beautiful palm tree. People came to cut down and uproot the cedar and to leave the palm tree by itself. Then the palm tree cried out and said, "Do not cut the cedar, for both of us are of one family." So the cedar was left alone for the sake of the palm tree and was not cut down. So this is going to be a prophetic dream. If you think about it, Avram's telling Sarai to lie in this fashion has two problems at least. One, it's a lie. And two, he's endangering Sarai. When you turn this into a prophetic dream, if this had occurred, if we had seen this in Medrash, we would have said, oh, how nice. What a nice way of solving the problem. He had a dream and he knew that he was supposed to do these things. This is not a rabbinic text. I'm not going to even use the term midrash, even though generically it reads very much like something that we would call midrash. And of course, it should be obvious to us, where is this imagery coming from? And one of the interpretations, by the way, that you find in Chazal on that pasuk is that refers to Avram and Sarai. So, okay, a bonus. So he wakes up, tells Sarai he's scared, and she says, "Tell me the dream." And I told her the dream, and I said, now, let's pay attention to this language, "They will try to kill me and let you alone. Only this be the whole kindness which you do with me. Wherever we are, say regarding me, he is my brother." They've taken the pasuk from the Abimelech story and embedded it. Now it goes back to Vahi Kashir Hisu Osi Elohim Vesavi. It was, this is what, when I'm wandering initially, I told this to her, and look how it's embedded. Because the rest of the pasuk, "I will live because of you, and my life will be spared on your behalf." He's come back to the language from Lech Lecha. He's taken the pasuk from, and this is stylistically a very cool thing to do, right? He's taken the pasuk from Vayera, and he's embedded it into the pasuk from Lech Lecha, and the whole thing reads very, very smoothly. Now, there are two other texts in antiquity. Josephus is also about 2,000 years ago, and the Bereishis Rabbah is a little later. Josephus writes, and he's writing a history of the Jews, and early on he's telling the story, and he tells the story also sticking in things that we would call Medrash, things he knew Baal Peh, and so on. And he says, "He took Sarah with him, and fearing Egyptians' frenzy for women, lest the king should slay him because of his wife's beauty, he devised the following scheme. He pretended to be her brother and instructed her to carry out her part accordingly." So you see that, first of all, Josephus has this negative attitude to Egyptians and their behavior vis-a-vis women elsewhere in his... he says the same thing, by the way, as I recall, in the story in Shmos. Why are we going to kill all the male children and keep the female children? For that reason. So it's Josephus Lishitaso that the Egyptians are Lishitaso, that this is how they apparently behave. So this is a different kind of explanation of the moral question. And it's very, very close to the interpretation that we find in Bracious Rabbah as well. The language is certainly not politically correct, and I'm not so proud of it necessarily. Now that we are entering a place of repulsive and dark people, please say that you are my sister so that it go well with me because of you. So here also, the excuse for breaking any kind of moral code is that this is a danger. These people are dangerous. So, what we have to realize here, the story of Avram and Sarai is told with a lot of gapping. And that's very much the way that Torah narrative is told. Torah narrative tends not to be very, very detailed and explicit about all kinds of things. That's what gives Chazal and anybody else who's writing in antiquity the ability to fill out the story, or fill in the details of the story in such a way that fits with whatever ideology they are going to be promulgating. So this is a sort of classic example. Now, there are a variety of other, and this is a very long section. I mean, there's one really neat passage where you get the Egyptian nobles give a whole speech to Pharaoh about her beauty. The Torah just says, "Vayirosa sarei faro, vayhaluosa el paro." The author of this document writes a whole poem about Sarai's beauty, which, by the way, retards the action, so you're sitting there waiting to see what's going to come next. So it has a double effect. But he, top to bottom, "And there is no bride that enters into the bridal bower who is as beautiful as she." This is not a young woman. But nevertheless, in great detail, and that's part of the story. But, you know, the question that we all would like to know the answer to is, how long was Sarai in Pharaoh's palace? And what happened? And who told Pharaoh? So, the Genesis Apocryphon, again, telling its own story, "The Most High God sent the spirit to plague him, an evil spirit upon all his household, and he was unable to approach her." Now, if you think about it, that's very similar to the Chazal that Rashi quotes, "He called Makas Rasan Shatash Mishkoshelo." But it's the same kind of thing. And although he was with her for 2 years, he did not know her. So we have a supernatural defense or protection of Sarai. And she's there for 2 years, and Pharaoh cannot do anything. How does he find out? I didn't give you this little piece. He calls Lot, and he says, "You know, I know that your uncle is a very wise and pious man. I'd like him to pray for me so that I'm cured of this disease." And Lot says, "Not while you're holding on to his wife there." Yeah. And it goes from there. Now, Josephus, and here you see, I've given you the text of Josephus. "The king was fired with a desire to see her, and on the point of laying hands upon her," and play the music in the background, right? "But God thwarted his criminal passion by an outbreak of disease and political disturbance." I guess those two go together. "And when he had sacrifices offered to discover a remedy, the priests declared that his calamity was due to the wrath of God because he had wished to outrage the stranger's wife." So again, it is a sort of supernatural protection. He finds out from his own people, right? His own Comarim, or whatever we're going to call them, come together. They make sacrifices because they realize that when you're having disease and political disturbances, you have to find out what's happening and do something about it. And he finds out that this is what's going on. So in both of these interpretations, there is a, in one case, there is a spirit sent to plague him directly, and the other one, there's an outbreak which forces him to pay attention to government, and he can't do his deed. Perhaps more interestingly is the passage in Bereishis Rabbah. And again, it's always interesting to compare the ancient sources, which are working roughly at the same time. Bereishis Rabbah is a few hundred years later. Josephus is probably within 100 years of the Apocryphon or thereabouts. Bereishis Rabbah says, "Shem ben Lachish b'shem bar Kappara." Paro was stricken with a severe form of leprosy, and as I said, if I remember correctly, Rashi says, "Shatash mish koshelo," he couldn't do what he wanted to do. Reb Levi says, all that night, and according to Chazal, Sara is with Paro for only one night. So we have, on the one hand, the story expanded to a 2-year stay in the Genesis Apocryphon, and one night and one night only in Chazal. All night the angel was standing with a whip in his hand. If she said to him, "Strike," he would strike. If she said, "Hold back," he would hold back. So by Nagah Hashem, right. Here I want you to pay attention to the pasuk that I just muttered. Why? What is the midrashic hook for this statement by Rabbi Levi? Al Devar, very good. So God smote Paro and his household. Al Devar Sarai Eshes Avram, at the command of Sarai, the wife of Avram. So the midrash there gives yet a different twist to the story, but with a very, very typical midrashic technique. They read the words al devar sarai and said, "Oh, devar, word, command," and this is where it comes from. So, each of these, and I'll call loosely midrashic sources, because when we're talking about in a story like this, and we look at Josephus, and we look at Genesis Apocryphon, and we look at Lahamtul Chazal, we're looking at Midrash in all of the cases. We do not know. The Torah doesn't tell us the details of this story in any way. But it does tell us, it gives us room to be creative, to fill out, to flesh out the story in these ways. And each of these interpreters, or shall I say, each of these retellers of the story, finds a way for the story to be retold creatively. In fact, it's in the Apocryphon, Avram eventually cures Paro by laying on of hands, which is the earliest source for that peculiar kind of technique which we find in antiquity. But in all of these cases, both in the first case, where we find on a Pshuto Shemikra level, the Dead Sea Scroll text falling into line, let's say, with some of the positions of the Rishonim, and here in what I'll call a non-pshuto sense, in a place where your midrashic creativity has to fill it out, we see how Jews in late Bayit Sheni were reading Chumash, how they were reading Parshas Lech Lecha. This is not a question of halacha. This is not a question here of any kind of theological dispute. It's a question of, I'm reading the story, and we're going to talk about it in shul, or I'm going to teach it to my children. How do I fill in the holes of the story? And here we see several different ways in which 2,000 years ago they were reading Parshas Lech Lecha.
Thank you very much.
What? Rashi follows Seder Olam. Yeah. It's attributed to Yosef and Chalafta. Yeah.